You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's a continuation of Last Dance by Alice Robb, with illustrations by James Taylor Gay. Opening illustration shows two dancers in the studio warming up at bar. On an unseasonably hot day in the fall of 2017, four dozen dancers descended on the small city of Charleston, South Carolina. Seasoned soloists from major companies, as well as students fresh out of dance school, they were lucky members of the newly formed American National Ballet. Their new jobs, they believed, represented not only the fulfillment of their own dreams, but a revolution in the field of ballet. A and B's husband and wife founders, businessmen Doug Benefield and Ashley Benefield, herself a former dancer, appeared to have deep pockets and a noble mission, to highlight racially diverse and physically unconventional dancers. Their first hire was Sarah Michelle Morosky, a stunning 5'10" dancer who said she had lost her previous job because of her above-average height. "I want dancers who aren't the cookie-cutter dancers," Ashley had told Morosky, who started crying and when they hung up thought, "This is really what I want to do." At 5'9", Ashley said that she had dealt with similar obstacles in her own career. Another recruit was then 20-year-old Hannah Manka, who had the opposite problem and usually fudged her barely 5 feet on her resume. The offer from the Benefields was a lifeline. As Manka recalls, "After working so hard and trying for so long, I was like, oh my gosh, all this work finally has paid off." A&B pledged to redress not only height and size discrimination, but the notorious whiteness of classical ballet. Each new hire, at the behest of their new bosses, posted a photo on Instagram with a hashtag, hashtag We Embrace Diversity, or hashtag A&B Family. Christopher Charles McDaniel had spent years as the only black dancer at Los Angeles Ballet before deciding to join A&B. "There was so much hope for what could happen with this new company," he said. "And in a world where even the most established companies struggle for funding, A&B seemed to have no shortage of cash." The fledgling troupe, 47 dancers in all, reportedly had an annual budget of $2.5 million, and its dancers were promised 8-month contracts, health insurance, and, for those who had been recruited from Germany or Argentina or Estonia, American visas. The dancers had been urged to sign year-long leases at a luxury apartment complex that boasted flat-screen TVs and free tanning beds. "The best part, you can see the main studios from the apartments," wrote an A&B administrator. "Not even a 2-minute walk. But wait, there's more," the email continued in the manic tone of a telemarketer. "We are building a rehearsal studio space on the ground level of the apartments." On the day they arrived, the dancers were greeted with a pizza party and a photo shoot. "They had a film crew following us around to talk about how excited we were," said McDaniel. But even as they gave interviews and posed for the cameras, some of the dancers tried to suppress lingering doubts. When, over the previous months, some had inquired about A&B's repertoire and performance schedule, they had received vague, blustery emails in response. "There are big things in store for A&B, a deputy director told them in late July. We're changing the face of ballet. We will be making lots of announcements in the upcoming weeks. Those announcements were yet to come, and the dancers still didn't know where they would perform. As they moved their bags into their apartments, the dancers noticed that there was no studio in sight, not at the ground level, and nowhere nearby. There were all these different stories about why the building couldn't be finished, said McDaniel. In the meantime, they would be taking class at a small studio 5 miles from the apartment building. It was super, super tiny, remembers Manka. There weren't even windows. We barely all fit on the bars. Most mysteriously of all, Ashley, the company's co-founder, director, and raison d'etre, was nowhere to be seen. On the first day, Doug said she would be there at the end of the week, said Kimberly Thompson, whose A&B contract represented an acceptance of her more muscular physique. But she never came. Unbeknownst to the dancers, she had moved to Florida. As the dancers studied with local teachers and waited for the rehearsal schedule to go up, they heard ever more grandiose versions of A&B's plans. There would be not just a ballet company, they gleaned, but also a conservatory, a line of dancewear, a media company. There was going to be a competition-style reality TV show inviting viewers to vote on casting. Doug was quoted in the press saying that he was Uberizing ballet. He said, I'm an engineer, a dancer recalled. He wanted to engineer some pointe shoes. Some of the international dancers, who were still at home, waiting for their visas, started to panic. Luciano Perotto, a recent graduate of Philadelphia's prestigious rock school, had turned down a full-time offer from the Atlanta Ballet to dance with A&B. He sat at his computer in Buenos Aires, watching his colleagues upload photos from Charleston, and wondered when he could join them. On October 1st, 2 weeks after he was supposed to start, he emailed the Benefields. I found out, really concerning the lack of communication with you, not being able to find the reason why my visa process was frozen, and not finding any help from your part, he wrote. And then, on payday, came a red flag no employee could ignore. The managers were all fumbling around like, oh, we can't pay you today, said McDaniel. Eventually, the dancers did get paid, not in direct deposits or checks, but in wads of cash stuffed in envelopes. No taxes, no receipt, cash, McDaniel emphasized. On Friday, October 20th, barely a month after they had arrived, the dancers were called to the small studio and asked to sign non-disclosure agreements. A woman named Beth Bogush, hired as chief operating officer, passed out the forms. We were all told that something big and amazing was about to happen, and assigned the forms to find out what it was, said the 19-year-old Anne Plowden. Many of them didn't understand the NDAs, but they had been trained to comply with authority, and they were grateful for work, so they signed. 3 days later, almost half the company was let go. Bogush told the Post and Courier that the 23 layoffs reflected a change in vision, assuring the reporter that the laid-off dancers had been given a fair shot. Ashley, who said she had not been informed of the dismissals, was furious. This is what everybody hates about the ballet world. It is what we were supposed to fight against, she fumed to her husband over text. On the A&B Facebook page, which had for months beamed relentless positivity, the footage of a dancer lifting her arms was pushed down the feed, and a message from Ashley appeared, her first communication since the season had begun. I publicly disavow my support for American National Ballet and its leadership, she wrote. I have been on personal leave and heard secondhand about the devastation that took place. Sarah Murawski, ANB's biggest star, quit in protest. An upcoming collaboration with established contemporary dance troupe Complexions fell through. Within 2 months, most of the 47 dancers were unemployed in the middle of the season, many of them saddled with high-priced leases in a city with few opportunities for ballet. Perotto was still at home when he logged onto Facebook and saw that the company had fallen apart. I had lost all my other job offers, he said. I had nothing, and I had to start again. Meanwhile, Doug Benefield disappeared, just like his wife. I had absolutely no returned calls, no help, no nothing, and I was stuck here in Charleston, said choreographer Alexandra Poirier. I've never seen so many lies, so many people hurt for something that's supposed to be celebrating diversity. Was the dream ever real? Asked ANB's erstwhile artistic director, Rasta Thomas, or did I really get hoodwinked? These were questions posed when I began reporting what I initially thought was the story of the doomed company after coming across a piece on the Point website. I had no idea that I would be spending the next 3 years piecing it together, or that it was a story in only the earliest stage of unfolding. Eventually, it would take me from the site of the half-built studio in Charleston to family court in southern Florida, and ultimately to a South Carolina beach where a family scattered their loved ones' ashes. The seeds of the American National Ballet had been planted a year earlier, in the summer of 2016, when Doug Benefield and Ashley Byers met at the Palm Beach home of Ben Carson after he ended his presidential campaign. It was a coup de foudre. At 54, divorced and widowed, Doug was confident and charismatic, slightly grizzled but still handsome. 24-year-old Ashley was classically beautiful, with bright blue eyes, glossy brown hair, and the elegant poise of a dancer. We started talking and never stopped, Ashley said. She sounded wistful when we spoke for the first time back in 2018, even as she was seeking a restraining order against Doug. Ashley had been a member of Donald Trump's campaign entourage, traveling to rallies and working in the campaign's Florida office, while Doug was close with some of Carson's big donors. Both were passionate about God and the Second Amendment. After they parted that night, Doug sent Ashley a text filled with laughing emojis and smiling faces and exclamation points. Loved the time with you, Ashley Oakley. With 3 exclamation points, he wrote. She had been carrying a gun in her bra at the party. The event was on August 25th. By the 26th, Ashley was addressing Doug as my dear and thanking God for bringing him into her life. On the 27th, Doug flew to Israel for a week-long work trip, and he and Ashley continued to text with the incessant pace and desperate tone of lovesick teenagers. Are you always this sweet and awesome? Ashley asked after Doug invited her to join him on his next trip. Always, except when shooting something, he replied. They sent each other hearts and Bible verses and favorite songs. She liked classical and country. He liked Frank Sinatra and praise music, which he sometimes put on when he left the house for the angels to enjoy. A wake-up text from Doug to Ashley. Good morning, and big hugs and some sunshine to get your day going. With 3 exclamation points. And a few hours later, her response. I am currently at my favorite place, the best place on earth, my amazing church. 3 exclamation points. Have heavenly time, Doug wrote back. On September 1st, 6 days after they met, they exchanged I love yous over text. By the time Doug landed, they had decided to marry. Doug, according to a friend, would not have sex with Ashley before the wedding night. They told almost no one of their plans, not even Doug's teenage daughter. Undeterred by their 30-year age gap and the fact that they had met just 13 days prior, they wed at St. Michael's Episcopal Church in Charleston on September 6th, with no guest except a witness and Doug's friend Trip Cormony officiating. Doug believed that this was a chance to essentially rescue someone, said his cousin and close friend Tommy Benefield. There wasn't any doubt that she saw him as a rescuer and a solution to her life situation. Ashley had been married and divorced and had opened up to Doug about a traumatic past that, she said, included paternal abandonment and a rocky first marriage. By the time Ashley was 21, the ballet career she had trained for from the age of 8 and for which she had dropped out of high school had fizzled out. "Ballet was absolutely my passion," she said. "If I could have cut off my feet in order to dance, I would have." She booked a few gigs with regional troupes, but legions of talented dancers far exceed the handful of available full-time jobs. Ashley began teaching children's courses and sewing costumes for student workshops. An attempt to pivot to modeling yielded a glamorous portfolio. Ashley pouting seductively in lingerie, posing en pointe in a city street, leaning against a wall in a gauzy wedding gown. But no career. Most of all, she yearned for a family, for a wedding that was more than a photo shoot. "I know what I want, more than anything. I want to love and be loved," Ashley wrote in her journal in 2014. "I want to be a wife and a mother." She prayed to God, "Please bring to me that special man you have chosen for me." In late 2015, she met Trump at a campaign event, and she told me, "My career took an incredibly different turn." She had admired Trump for years and said he was so impressed with her patriotism and her knowledge of guns that he offered me a job on the spot. Soon, she was spending long days at crowded rallies, sleeping at Mar-a-Lago, and traveling on Trump's plane. Mr. Trump watched himself on TV most of the flight. Her diary entries show a young woman smitten with Mr. Trump and his attention. In a journal from the winter of 2016, with a psalm printed on each page, Ashley recorded in neat, schoolgirlish handwriting how flattered she was when Trump asked her opinion on what color tie to wear. And when, a few days later, he called her on the phone. "He said I looked good in his plane. He called me a bombshell. He called me his little girl and his baby. He said he wanted a big fat kiss and promised her a job at the White House." Trump shown a picture of himself, and Ashley said, "I have no idea who this person is." Doug had been making small contributions over the years to the Republican National Committee. Like his new wife, he had a penchant for reinvention. In donor records from 2014 to 2016, he lists his occupation alternately as venture capital, engineer, and entrepreneur. It seemed like he was always trying to find his niche, said Noah Schiffman, a computer scientist who knew Doug on and off for 20 years. Doug, a Navy veteran, had an entrepreneurial spirit and had started different businesses, some real estate stuff. At one point, he was part owner of some restaurant, always doing different things. He liked technology. William Want, a former professor at the Charleston School of Law, who invested in one of Doug's projects in the 1990s, perceives something more sinister in Doug's serial entrepreneurialism. Doug and Want had known each other casually for several years when Doug mentioned an opportunity to invest in his new TV production company. After coughing up an amount Want said he was too embarrassed to disclose, the project fell apart. Want came to believe he had been swindled. Doug would talk to funders, claiming he had funds, but he didn't, said Want. He and a couple others involved in the venture had just spent wildly enjoying themselves on investor money. Want eventually sued Doug. I knew I wouldn't get any money, he said, but I was just pissed off enough that I wanted to do it for humankind, to put this suit out there to warn other people. Doug and Ashley were still getting to know each other when they hatched the idea for A&B. When he found out that I was a dancer, he just went crazy over that because he had always loved classical ballet, Ashley told me. None of Doug's friends who I spoke to could recall him ever mentioning ballet. In a text to Ashley, he spelled pirouettes with a W. He insisted on taking her to the ballet, even though Ashley hadn't been in years. It's a little bit hard to be on the wrong side of the stage. As they drove home from that performance, the newlyweds talked about Ashley's ideas for ballet and how it could be improved. Doug was talking about how we should really do something here, pointing out that you couldn't get a better city than Charleston to start something big. The White House job Trump had purportedly promised Ashley had not materialized, and she agreed. But even as the couple made plans to start a company together, merging their lives wasn't going smoothly. Ashley moved into Doug's house in Mount Pleasant, an idyllic suburb of Charleston where American flags wave from stoops and kids bounce on trampolines. But she struggled to bond with her new stepdaughter, Eva, who was 15 and still mourning the loss of her mother, Doug's second wife, Renee Cusar Benefield. His first marriage, when he was 28, lasted only about 6 months. "It was 9 months after my mom died," Eva told me in June. "I was like, what the heck?" I kinda was in shock. At first, Ashley tried to befriend the grieving teenager, sharing her favorite video clips of ballet, taking her shopping for houseplants, and helping her repot them in mason jars on the porch. But just a month after the wedding, she called Cormany, panicking that Doug would choose Eva over her. "She was just hysterical," Cormany said. "I just said, Ashley, what is the bottom line here? What are you so upset about?" She said, "I just want him to pick me." The age gap could be awkward. She was closer in age to her stepdaughter than to her new husband. Schiffman, the computer scientist who shared office space with Doug, said Ashley seemed immature. The first time she visited Charleston, Doug took her by the office and introduced them. "I said something to the effect of, 'You've got Doug here to show you around and take care of you while you're here.' Ashley responded, 'I can take care of myself.' And, to Schiffman's alarm, pulled a gun out of her jean shorts. It was very bizarre, Schiffman said. She did it in a sort of giggling manner. I didn't feel threatened, but it's a very socially awkward thing to do when you first meet someone. But Doug and Ashley were in love. In January 2017, they started writing together in a 5-year Q&A-a-day journal, The Notes of Doug and Ashley, 2017 to 2021. Both responded to prompts like, "If you could go back in time and change something, what would it be?" "Doug, be with Ashley a whole life." "Ashley, I love him." And, "What is your mission?" "Ashley, make a happy home for my family." And a drawing of a heart. "Doug, become Christ-like." "Who do you feel closest to?" the journal asked in April 2017. "Ashley, she is part of me," Doug wrote in loopy script. "Ashley, Doug, I never want to be without him." But that summer, as they put action behind their big ideas for A&B, holding auditions along the East Coast, scouting choreographers, and hustling for funds, tension kept mounting. "Doug was very, very close to Eva," said Tommy Benefield. "We were best friends," Eva said. "I told him everything. All the boy drama, all of the friend drama. He came to all my lacrosse games." When she was older and they lived in different cities, Doug texted Eva a Bible verse when he woke up, every single morning without a doubt. Still, Ashley wanted a child of her own, and she asked Doug to have his vasectomy reversed. It didn't help that Doug was sinking money into the ballet, praying that the bet would pay off. The gushing, sappy entries in their shared journal taper off. Stress creeps in. "Something that made you worry today?" the journal asked in June. "Crazy ballet timelines," Ashley wrote. "Is something in your way?" it prompted. "Yes," they both answer. In June, Ashley found Eva's diary and read it, learning that her stepdaughter hated her. Doug and Ashley argued. They yelled. Doug grabbed a gun. Weapons were never far away, and threw it against the wall. "I was just in utter disbelief. Everything going on in our life, a lot of stress," he later said. The fight resumed. In the heat of one argument, he punched a hole in the wall. Another time, Doug picked up a gun and fired it into the ceiling. That same day, he struck the family dog in the face. He later confessed in a written statement, "Sully starts to jump up from under the table, and I, sadly, just hit him." Outwardly, they tried to project happiness. A few days after Doug lodged a bullet in his ceiling, the couple hosted a wedding reception for themselves. In a photo snapped in a downtown Charleston hotel, they grin as though they can't believe their luck. Ashley, in a beaded white gown and floor-length train, her long hair loose around her shoulders. Doug, beaming and tanned, his chest pressed against her back. "I'm a ballet dancer," Ashley told me. "I can look happy, no matter what's going on in my life. I put on one hell of a show." In August, just weeks before the dancers were due to arrive, Ashley learned that she was pregnant. She had longed for a child, but the physical symptoms were worse than she expected. The nausea was so intense that the former athlete was sometimes too weak to stand up or take a shower. "Baby, I feel so effing horrible," she texted Doug on August 16th. "Baby, I literally can't move. I feel so sick." They decided that Ashley should rest at her mother's house in Florida, while Doug stayed in Charleston to focus on the ballet. In the first weeks of their separation, Doug and Ashley texted each other with a yearning that recalled the early days of their romance. "I miss you. So bad I'm nauseated, too," Doug wrote. "No words can describe how bad I miss you," he wrote on September 16th. "Love and miss you, too," Ashley replied. 2 days later, her doting messages came to an abrupt halt. On September 18th, the long-awaited launch date of the American National Ballet, Doug went to the studio to oversee the dancers' arrival. That same day, Ashley set out on the 500-mile drive to South Carolina. She didn't tell Doug she was coming. She quietly let herself into the home they had shared, packed up her clothing, and left him a note. She was leaving. "I can honestly tell you that I am completely heartbroken," her letter began. Over the next 4 pages, she set forth 21 bullet-pointed complaints, covering his behavior. "You yell, scream, and cuss at me. You have thrown and broken things, even a loaded gun, which left a giant hole in the wall. And the condition of his house. Black mold on the walls, unsafe tap water, exposed outlets. Do not harass or try to follow me, or I will call the police and have a restraining order against you." She concluded, "Do not call me or my mom. We will not pick up." "I just read the note. I don't even know how to start responding," Doug texted Ashley later that day. "I am sorry I wasn't a stronger, better man through everything. I will never act the way you talk about again," he promised. For the next month, she ignored his desperate pleas and daily apologies. He told her he was going to therapy and locking up his guns. "I will never raise my voice to you," he vowed on September 19th. Thank you, amazing woman of God, for being you, he wrote the following week. I am constantly sending angels to guard and protect you and our baby. Ashley responded, only to debrief about ballet contracts and to thank him for adding money to her account. Doug was undeterred. We are perfect together, he wrote, unprompted, on October 2nd. I've just never loved this deep before, he wrote on October 9th. I lost it. I admit it and know it. While Ashley tried to regain her strength in Florida, Doug was in Charleston, scrambling to keep ANB afloat. The reported $2.5 million budget had never existed, but Doug still hoped he could raise the money before anyone caught on. He borrowed tens of thousands of dollars to fund the first payroll. On October 23rd, the day half of the dancers were fired and Ashley disavowed the whole enterprise on Facebook, Doug begged her to take down her post. You are hurting the dancers who are staying, he wrote. What about all the people whose lives were just ruined, she replied. It was too late. There's no money, he wrote a few days later. You have no idea how bad I want out of this, and only desired to cover the 40 dancers hired. In Florida, meanwhile, Ashley felt her health was not improving. I had horrible, sharp pains in my stomach, horrible pains in my chest, she said. It felt like my entire body was going to explode. She visited doctors and took powerful medications, but to no avail. Some days, she could barely get out of bed. Still searching for a diagnosis in November, she decided to send a lock of her hair to a lab company. I got my results back and was blown away, she said. The lab said it had detected dangerous levels of aluminum, cobalt, zinc, tin, and barium in her body. Their explanation was shocking. Ashley had been deliberately and systematically exposed to these toxins by an individual who may be identified as the poisoner, according to the lab. Ashley thought about the hot sweet tea Doug used to make her every morning. She had an idea of who the poisoner might be. Ashley thought, too, about Eva's mother, Renee, who was 56, when she was found face down in bed in the house she shared with Doug. In pictures, she looks happy and fit, practically glowing with health. When police in Mount Pleasant investigated Renee's death and searched her cell phone, they learned that she and Doug had been fighting. The decedent stated to her husband how he kicked her over New Year's Eve during their honeymoon. They summarized in an investigation report, and also described Mr. Benefield putting a gun to his head in the past. In the year before her death, Renee had been sick. Her husband told the detectives that she had fainted twice in the past year. The coroner concluded that she had died of a heart condition. After Ashley told me that she had been poisoned, I told her I was sorry about what she had been through. I didn't have a reason to doubt her. I was impressed by her poise as she told me how, even as she cared for her new baby, she had pivoted from ballet to activism. I'm looking at ways that I can help bring awareness to poisoning, she said. It's more common than you would think. She told me about the other poisoning victims she had gotten to know, including a Texas winery owner and an Arizona newspaperman. They had met through the forensics business that had analyzed their results, the Carlson Company. A toxicologist warned Ashley that she had absorbed extra poison because a pregnant woman will breathe in 7 times more air than a non-pregnant woman, as well as ingest 7 times more food and nutrients. The Carlson Company had a high profile. In 2013, after the 32-year-old actress Brittany Murphy died at home, her grieving father refused to accept the coroner's cause of death, pneumonia, and sent a clipping of her hair to the Carlson Company. He got back a report stating that she, like Ashley, had been the victim of intentional heavy metal poisoning. The claim was widely reported and then roundly debunked. An expert toxicologist called it baseless and ridiculous. A representative for the Carlson Company said that the Carlson Company of 2013 has no association with the Carlson Company of today, although they bear the same name, are located in the same place, Westminster, Colorado, and work with the same lab, managed by Ernest Lachisa. Although Lachisa's lab results have been questioned in the past, he and the Carlson Company are still in business. Their results have been admitted in court, at least as recently as 2019, when hair analysis from Lachisa's lab wrongly indicated that the plaintiff in a date rape case had GHB levels 7 times higher than normal. On July 30, 2018, Ashley and Doug saw each other for the first time in 10 months at the Manatee County Courthouse in Florida. 4 months earlier, Ashley had checked herself into Tampa General Hospital without telling Doug and delivered a baby girl. I sat in the back row as Doug filed in, a few minutes late, with his lawyer, Stephanie Murphy, a powerful-looking woman with a glossy bob and tassels on her shoes. Ashley, with her long straight hair and sleeveless summer dress, looked nervous and young. She kept her eyes down as Doug entered the courtroom and took a seat, his suit the same shade of gray as the stubble on his jaw. Doug was seeking custody of their 4-month-old daughter, whom he'd never met, while Ashley, alleging domestic violence and attempted poisoning, wanted a restraining order. Murphy confronted Ashley with a dramatic reading of the affectionate text she had sent Doug in 2017. She insisted that she had only been trying to appease a husband who frightened her. Ashley's voice quavered as she told the judge, "It is heartbreaking that somebody you would trust would do something to you." She had dropped out of high school and was prone to conspiracy thinking. She didn't believe in vaccinating her child. After an 8-hour hearing that stretched over 2 days, the judge denied Ashley's request and ordered the parents to share custody. There is not a single scintilla of credible evidence that Ms. Benefield has ever been poisoned or suffered from any illness of any poison, Judge Diana Moreland ruled. But Ashley said the Carlson Company's report substantiated her worst suspicions. In December 2017, not long after Ashley got the result of her hair analysis, Doug sent her a gift that included tea bags from Tivana. And she not only refrained from drinking the tea, she also drove the package to the Manatee County Sheriff's Office and had it examined by a specialist from the Hazardous Materials Response Team. In June, apparently concerned that her daughter could have been poisoned in utero, Ashley sought out the hyperbaric centers of Southwest Florida and signed up for her 3-month-old daughter for 26 sessions in an oxygen chamber. Hyperbaric oxygen therapy is typically administered to scuba divers suffering from decompression sickness or firefighters with carbon monoxide poisoning. And yet, after all this, the collapse of the dance company, the ongoing and vicious court battles, Ashley and Doug began spending time together again. In November 2018, they enlisted the help of a marriage counselor. I last spoke with Ashley in July 2018. In January 2019, Ashley and Doug were photographed together in black tie at the Sarasota Ballet Gala, looking every bit the glossy golden couple. But Ashley apparently still didn't trust Doug. On Easter weekend of 2019, the whole family went out to dinner, and Ashley and her mother pulled Eva aside. They asked if I felt safe living with him. They told me he killed my mother. They told me my dad was going to kill Ashley and her mother, Eva wrote in a statement. I tried multiple times to defuse the situation by telling them my dad has been nothing but supportive. That summer, Doug grew suspicious of Ashley. He sometimes had trouble reaching her. He secretly placed a tracking device on her car and hired a private investigator who told him that Ashley was seeing someone else. This time, the separation was his idea. But his anger didn't last. He still hoped that they could move in together and be a family again. Even as Ashley continued to fight for full custody, Doug thanked his estranged wife over a text for being an amazing woman and for giving birth to their precious baby. He forgave her for the affair and begged her to withdraw her accusations. She, meanwhile, maintained that he had poisoned Renee and tried to poison her. In November 2019, the marriage counselor discovered that Doug had been secretly recording their sessions and terminated the couple's therapy. She continued to treat Ashley alone. In May last year, 2 months into lockdown, Ashley appeared to have the change of heart Doug had been waiting for. She texted Doug and said she wanted to talk. "She's looking to go to a real trauma therapist together," Doug told Murphy over email, very conciliatory and owned her mistakes. They started tentatively going on dates, to restaurants, to the beach. Ashley even suggested they move together to Maryland, where Ashley had grown up, and where Doug was starting a new job, for a fresh start. Murphy warned Doug that Ashley, whose poisoning allegations had come to naught in Florida, might have ulterior motives. "It has long been my belief, sorry, I know you don't want to hear this, that Ashley could be using this opportunity to forum shop, looking for a new jurisdiction, a new judge, to whom she can restart this story case, since she has not had any luck," she wrote on August 31st. "I have the same concern," Doug admitted. "I do not trust her at all, no matter how much I hope for her change." But he rented a U-Haul anyway. "With sincere heart and love, and excited to begin next stage of our shared journey," he emailed Ashley on September 14th. On the evening of Sunday, September 27th, 2020, Ashley and Doug were together at Ashley's mother's house in Florida, packing up her belongings. A custody hearing was scheduled for the 30th. They planned to attend via Zoom. A psychologist's evaluations of Ashley and Doug were set to be released at the hearing. The reports, which Doug would never hear, reveal their conflicting states of mind. Ashley had no interest in reconciling. Doug did not believe in divorce. On Monday morning, back in Charleston, Eva woke up, checked her phone, and saw no Bible verse, nothing. She sent her dad a good morning text, but he didn't reply. An hour passed, and she texted him again. She started to panic. "Dad, where are you?" she wrote. "Dad, you're scaring me. Answer the phone." She drove to her sister-in-law's and Googled Florida car accident Benefield. The night before, a neighbor of Ashley's had called 911. When the sheriff's deputies arrived, they found Doug on the floor of Ashley's bedroom, bleeding from his leg, arm, and chest. They found a stray bullet on the floor and two more lodged in the walls. Ashley, who told police that she could still hear ringing in her ears, maintains she acted in self-defense. The police, according to the felony complaint, noticed no injuries on Ashley apart from an old and very minor scratch. Based on the entry wounds on Douglas, it does not appear that he was facing Ashley when she began shooting, the detective wrote. It also does not appear that Douglas had taken any kind of defensive or combative stance. Ashley's striking mugshot went viral. "Ashley has not returned any of my calls or emails since the shooting. Neither has her mother or her lawyer," the prosecutor declined to comment. "She is currently out on bond and living in Florida near her mother and daughter while she awaits trial. She has been charged with murder in the second degree and unpremeditated killing. On her application for a public defender, she said that she had no cash, no bank account, and no savings." She adheres to an 11 p.m. curfew and wears an ankle bracelet around the clock. On October 17, 2020, Doug's friends and family scattered his ashes in the water at Sullivan's Island Beach, just a few miles from the home he had once shared with Ashley. Afterward, about 40 people gathered at nearby Dunleavy's Pub, a friendly Irish bar where every patron is buddy to the bartender and baby to the smiling waitress with blonde hair. "We don't care about social distancing, any of that," said Tommy, who organized the memorial service. Last year, Eva dropped out of the College of Charleston. Now 20, she works part-time at a coffee shop, sells paintings of landscapes on Etsy, and posts TikToks about evil stepmothers. One of her videos has been viewed nearly 23 million times. "I really want to talk to Ashley," Eva told me. "I just want to ask her, what was going through your head?" "I've thought about it every single day. Where did it go wrong? Why did that happen?" As for the dancers, who seemed to be the original victims, they are still struggling with the fallout, financial, professional, emotional. Hannah Menka spends her nights working as a server at a golf club, and her days alone in the studio, trying to stay in shape for another season of auditions. At just 29, Sarah Murawski doesn't feel ready to give up her performing career, but it took 2 years to procure another company job, which then fell through due to COVID. Today, she is teaching part-time at the school where she trained, and she's struggling to make sense of her experience in South Carolina. "Doug and Ashley were two people who both seemed very generous and gentle," she said. "This disillusionment has been very painful, confusing, and sad."
Thank you.
now for the people who produce Vanity Fair magazine. Editor-in-Chief Radhika Jones, Creative Director Kira Pollack, Deputy Editor Daniel Kyle, Executive Digital Director Michael Hogan, Director of Editorial Operations Karen Prime, Executive Editors Claire Howarth, Matthew Lynch, Executive Editor The Hive, Miriam Elder, Executive Hollywood Editor Jeff Giles, Director of Special Projects Sarah Marks, Global Head of Talent Allison Ward Frank, Managing Editor VF.com Kelly Butler, Awards and Audio Editor Katie Rich, Editor Creative Development David Friend, Senior West Coast Editor Brett Hinnemuth, Senior Editors The Hive Michael Calderon, Claire Lansbaum, Senior Hollywood Editor Hilary Bussis, Vanities Editor Maggie Coughlin, Senior Editor Keziah Weir, Entertainment Director Caitlin Brody, E-Commerce Editor Morgan M. Evans, Senior Media Correspondent Joe Pompeo, National Correspondent Emily Jane Fox, Politics Correspondent Boss Levin, Senior Hollywood Correspondent Anthony Bresnikan, Senior Vanities Correspondent Delia Kai, Senior Awards Correspondent Rebecca Ford, National Political Reporter Abigail Tracy, Chief Critic Richard Lawson, Senior Features Writer Julie Miller, TV Correspondent Joy Press, Senior Staff Writer Joanna Robinson, TV Critic Sonia Soraya, Art Columnist Nate Freeman, Staff Writers Dan Adler, Kinsey Bryant, David Canfield, Cassie DaCosta, Johanna Desta, Charlotte Klein, Chris Murphy, Aaron Vanderhoof, Staff Reporter Caleb Ekarma, Special Correspondents Nick Bilton, Brian Burrow, Joe Hagan, Maureen Orth, Jessica Pressler, Mark Seal, Gabriel Sherman, Writers at Large Marie Brenner, T.A. Frank, James Reginato, Web Producer Jamie Archer, Associate Producer Mayhem Hassan, Assistant to the Editor-in-Chief Daniela Tizarina, Editorial Assistants Aramita Diop, Kayla Holliday, Savannah Walsh, Special Projects Manager Ari Bergen, Special Projects Associate Charlene Oliver, Business Director Jeff Collins, Director of Product Mindy Yin, Design and Photography Design Director Justin Patrick Long, Visuals Director Tara Johnson, Art Director Emily Crawford, Senior Visuals Editors Lauren Margaret Jones, Kate Sturgis, Senior Visuals Editor Research Tim Herzog, Visuals Editor Allison Schaller, Digital Designer Quentin McMillan, Visuals Editor Research Eric Miles, Designer Justine Good, Associate Visuals Editor Madison Reed, Fashion and Beauty Fashion Director Nicole Chapoteau, Beauty Director Laura Regensdorf, Accessories Director Daisy Shaw Ellis, Senior Menswear Editor Miles Pope, Market Editor Kia D. Gooseby, Assistant Fashion Editors Samantha Gasmer, Jessica Nieces, Content Integrity Legal Affairs Editor Robert Walsh, Research Director David Gendelman, Copy Director Michael Casey, Associate Legal Affairs Editor Simon Brennan, Production Managers Beth Myers, Susan M. Rasco, Roberto Rodriguez, Research Managers Brendan Barr, Kelvin C. Bias, Michael Sachs. And those are just a few of the people who get Vanity Fair magazine to you every month. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.